From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for January the 8th, 2017. This is our weekly look at the ever-shifting landscape of politics from Chicago to Springfield and, of course, Washington, D.C. So once again, time to grab the Sunday paper, go get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. Well, it's good to be back in the Sunday morning chair after having a bit of time off, and I, of course, want to thank Amanda Vinicky, who was kind enough to sit in last Sunday's show to ring in the new year as she also launches her new gig as a correspondent for WTTW Chicago Tonight. And I know Dave had a little time off last Sunday, but I know your holidays were, you're the hardest working man in the news business. I mean, you were all over the place.
It was, like I said earlier to you, Rick, it was nice to have holidays off like normal people. But in between the Christmas and in between New Year, it was a lot of work, but we had a lot of fun, too. So it all works out well.
Well.
And welcome back to Sam.
Yes, absolutely. And Merry Serbian Christmas to you, Sam.
Merry Christos Sirodi. You know how to say that, right, Rick? Can you write that? Can you spell that?
No, I can't.
Okay. Well, we'll practice during the break.
Will you text that to me?
Sure.
Okay, fine. That's. Well, it's and Jasmine was off last Sunday, too. She's back. I mean, it's we got the whole band together this morning here.
Old home week.
And,
back for the new year.
So I hope your holidays were good, Dave and Sam.
Oh, yes. They sure were. I got to spend, like I said, having all of Christmas off, got to spend some great time with Dad again and some friends. And New Year's, I just laid low. Simply laid low, and it felt good.
By choice, or
yes, by
with
choice.
Somebody after you?
By choice.
Okay,
no, just, by choice.
I just,
yeah.
I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, it was nice to have a couple of Sundays to kind of remember what it was like to have normal hours on a Sunday.
And then I ran into you on Monday at the GOAT.
Yes, indeed.
For the hockey game. That was
right.
Fun. The 2nd of January, I spent it with Rick Pearson.
Yes. And I was with Amanda Vinicky and Paris Schutz from Channel 11. And we had did a little bit of kind of prognostication on the future of Springfield for 2017. And then got together to watch the Blackhawks game. Which wasn't all that great a game after all. The Winter Classics, I think, we're done with for a while.
They need a roof.
That's it.
Hawks need a roof.
It's got to be indoors. And I almost went. I had thought about going down to St. Louis.
And I told you not to go.
Well, and thankfully, I took your advice. Because I can't imagine. I mean, they were getting big money for those tickets.
It was 220 bucks. Plus the travel, plus the food, plus the hotel.
And, well, 220 might have been the face value because there were people paying over 350. And, that's pretty hefty freight for just to be able to say I sat outside in Busch Stadium. I mean, it's Busch Stadium. I mean, when they played at Wrigley, that would have been something special. But like I said, they've won like one out of six of these outdoor games.
They're 0-3 in the Winter Classic, and they're 1-4 outdoors. The only win came at Soldier Field.
Right. When it was snowing, I think.
Against Pittsburgh, yeah, a couple years back.
But, well, at least, they're after a bit of a losing streak, they're back on board. And tonight they play the Preds at 6 o'clock here at home. And, of course, you can catch all the action here. Judd Surratt has the pregame at 5:30, and the puck drops at 6 with John and Troy. So you gotta love it. The Hawks are at least making up for the fact that we have no football, no Bears in the football playoffs. Some good playoff games yesterday, for the most part, and be curious to see what Green Bay does this evening. So all kinds of good stuff. Did you guys get a lot of good gifts, by the way? I mean, anything notable?
I got a shovel.
Appropriately enough. You know, I got an Amazon Echo.
Oh, how do you like it?
It is amazing.
Is it really?
It really is. I mean, it is, and it's a sign of what the future is going to be like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but everything from I'm able to listen to WGN radio through it. I can use the Bluetooth and hook it up to my Bluetooth speakers and listen to the radio, listen to you can play Jeopardy on it. You can I can get the bus tracker through it. And there was actually this very funny story about because it's unless you've changed the settings, it's automatically hooked up to your Amazon purchases, so you can order.
Oh, of course it is.
Well, some little girl apparently asked Alexa to get her a dollhouse, and arriving on the steps of the house was this $167 dollhouse. But the
Santa Claus's name is now Alexa.
Yeah, right, correct. But the follow up to that story, and I guess it was a Seattle TV station did a story about the little girl that ordered the dollhouse, and the reporter in the story mentioned about how cute it was, and I'm not going to use the word, but the name that you called the device, ordering a dollhouse, and apparently just the reporter even mentioning this triggered Alexa in all of these homes.
Oh, no.
Yes. So there were multiple orders. Yes. So just fair warning there, too. But no, it's absolutely fantastic. And, you know, the fact that they were selling them for $40, $50.
That's all?
Yes.
Oh, boy. Hard to pass up there.
Yeah. And you can connect it to various different kind of apps and things. It's mm-hmm. it's a fascinating toy to play with.
It pretty really soon is. You'll be able to say, Alexa, green bean casserole, and they just whip it up in the kitchen.
Bacon, blue cheese, coleslaw.
Yeah. It'll be virtual. It won't be real.
Right.
That's
it'll
the
be
problem.
Virtual.
Yeah. I can't think of digital coleslaw being very tasty at all.
No.
No, does not sound good at all. But I'm telling you, check it out. Watch one of the videos on this thing, and it is absolutely amazing. But be careful of ordering.
Well, I have to admit that the commercials, the TV spots for this, they pique your interest. Well, you know, what you can do with this. You know, somebody will just say, "Hey, Alexa," you know, and it's interesting.
Well, and right now, for example, you can get Uber or Lyft through it. You can, I guess this was on the Super Bowl last year when they first came out with these, is not that we care here in Chicago, but you can order Domino's pizza through it. but I'm expecting, obviously, you know, if that can happen,
hey,
that some of these
everybody
pizza
else
places,
is going to follow
exactly,
suit.
Exactly. Yeah. So you'll be able to, you know, do all those kinds of things. I mean, that is pretty neat. But, yeah, it would be nice if it, you know, could do your taxes or something. Something of that nature would be helpful. But or if it could write my stories.
There you go.
You know, or take dictation. That would be very helpful. But, yeah, but, I mean, just if you're curious, and Google has its own version of this and stuff. But, I mean, check out some of the videos on how this thing works. It's my daughter got me one, and it's just very fascinating. Very fascinating stuff. But that's
now you have something to play with. You've got a toy here.
That's
for
well,
Christmas.
You know, it's not right to not get a toy at Christmas.
You're right.
So
that's true.
And so we'll see what happens with it. So stay tuned in future episodes of the Sunday Spin, because you know there's going to be a problem somewhere. It just has to happen. And and of course, watch. I'll have a dollhouse arriving in 2 days, probably. Oh man,
Pearson's Palace.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Well, Dave's back to keep us up on all the news. Producer Jasmine's here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SymbolSundaySpin. Engineer Bob is busy chipping the ice off the board that powers the mighty 720. As always, you can find our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching Rick Pearson. So far, Alexa hasn't figured that one out yet, though. Up ahead, after Dave gives us the 7:30 news update, we'll be speaking to veteran newsman Chris Burry. Chris, among his many duties, is also a special correspondent for PBS's NewsHour, and we'll talk about his look into Obamacare. Had a piece on the weekend edition of NewsHour last night dealing with Obamacare in Kentucky. And we'll talk about that and the Republican plans to repeal it. Dave's back with a news update at 8, and then we'll speak to the 47th Ward Northwest Side Alderman, Amaya Pawar. The alderman announced last week his intentions to seek the Democratic nomination for governor. And we'll talk about his bid in the early Democratic contest for next year. After the 8:30 news, we'll then speak with Raja Krishnamoorthy. Raja is the new congressman for the state's 8th District, the Northwest and West Suburbs, and Representative Krishnamoorthy is a Democrat, and he succeeds Tammy Duckworth, who was sworn in as the state's new senator. Well, that's all coming up, but first we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Good Sunday morning, 7:22 on this Sunday morning, chilly Sunday morning. Temperature is actually, over the last couple hours, has actually been going down by single degrees. We're currently at 4 degrees right now. We're supposed to get to a high of around 22. Hopefully that'll come very soon, because these last couple of days have really been a reminder of what it's supposed to be like in January in Chicago. Well, it's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And, you know, it seems like even though you can go away for a couple of weeks, our politics sometimes is like a soap opera. And you know, sometimes that storyline never changes. And that seems to be the case with President-elect Donald Trump and the issue of Russian hacking. The U.S. intelligence community has agreed in a report issued Friday that Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered a cyber hacking effort to disrupt the U.S. election process and to damage Hillary Clinton's candidacy. Now, as the report was being prepared, President-elect Trump used his favorite messaging machine, that being Twitter, to discount the effect of U.S. intelligence reports. And that prompted the director of the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, to make these comments in response to Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill about what disparaging the U.S. intelligence community actually means.
I think there is an important distinction here between healthy skepticism, which policymakers, to include policymaker number one, should always have for intelligence, but I think there's a difference between skepticism and disparagement.
And I assume that the biggest benefactors of the American people having less confidence in the intelligence community are, in fact, the actors you have named today: Iran, North Korea, China, Russia, and ISIS.
The intelligence community is not perfect. We are an organization of human beings, and we're prone sometimes to make errors. I don't think the intelligence community gets the credit it's due for what it does day in and day out to keep this nation safe and secure.
So Trump did get a briefing from the intelligence chiefs on Friday, and while he expressed some concerns about Russia, China, and others, he quickly issued a statement saying there was no evidence that Russia used hacking to change any actual votes. Still, he seems to be expressing an insecurity that people are casting doubt on the legitimacy of his presidency because of the hacking, and that frankly hasn't been an issue in Congress among Democrats or Republicans. Now here's Vice President-elect Mike Pence of Indiana trying to once again decipher the president-elect, something we'll probably see a lot of over the next 4 years.
We did this afternoon complete an extensive briefing from the leaders of our intelligence community. It was, as the president-elect said, it was a constructive and respectful dialogue. And the president-elect has made it very clear that we're going to take aggressive action in the early days of our new administration to combat cyber attacks and protect the security of the American people from this type of intrusion in the future. But I know the president-elect appreciated the presentation made by the leaders of our intelligence community, and I know the president-elect and I both appreciate the sacrifices that the men and women who serve in our intelligence services around the country and around the world provide in contributing to the safety and security of the American people.
That's Vice President-elect Mike Pence. Now, even after that statement, President-elect Trump tweeted out, "Gross negligence by the Democratic National Committee allowed hacking to take place. The Republican National Committee had strong defense." You know, here again, and then yesterday morning, he doubled down on stating that there was no evidence that hacking affected the election results. He added that the reason that the DNC hacking is being discussed is, quote, that the loss by the Dems was so big that they are totally embarrassed, unquote. So expect this to continue as the pressure still mounts in Washington to have further hearings on exactly what kind of cybersecurity measures we need to enact, as well as what kind of actions the U.S. may take going forward to Russia over this cyber intrusion of the U.S. political process. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Chris Burry, special correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, co-host of In the Loop on WYCC Television, and we'll talk about his report yesterday on PBS NewsHour about the effects of Obamacare in Kentucky and some of the changes that the new Matt Bevins, the new Republican governor there, is looking at making, and that might provide some insights of what we might be seeing as Republicans move forward in their efforts to both repeal and perhaps replace Obamacare.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
7:36 on this very cool Sunday morning. I was just out on the WGN Storm Center patio, and I can very much attest to the single-digit temperature and the wind chill out there, which is something to keep an eye on. It's the WGN, our Storm Center website says we're supposed to get to 22 today. I don't know how we're going to get there, but hopefully we'll get there soon, please.
We have clear skies right now. Sunrise will help.
No, it won't.
You know better than
don't
that.
Don't try to be optimistic here, guys.
Is that one of your New Year's resolutions?
Yes, actually it is.
Get rid of it. Well, this is your Sunday Spin. And joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Chris Burry. He's the special correspondent for PBS NewsHour, co-host of In the Loop on WYCC Television, and senior journalist in residence at Chicago's DePaul University. Chris, thanks so much for getting up with me this morning.
It's my pleasure. Happy to be here, Rick.
And Happy New Year to
you. Happy New Year to you.
You'd had a piece that aired on NewsHour last night dealing with the issue of Obamacare, and specifically taking a look at what Obamacare has meant for the state of Kentucky. And it was very fascinating because in many respects, Kentucky is kind of used as a national model of what successes have occurred when it comes to insuring people who weren't insured, people taking advantage. I think it was the New England Journal of Medicine had taken a look about effects of Obamacare and about people taking advantage of some of the preventatives rather than going to the old emergency room and the uncompensated care issues that hospitals face there. But I wondered if you could just give us just a brief summary of, you know, what the changes have brought to Kentucky.
Sure. Kentucky was considered a model, relatively poor state. As we know, Obamacare rolls out in 2013, and hundreds of thousands of people who never had insurance before sign up. And the rate of uninsured dropped just precipitously before Obamacare. One in five Kentuckians had no health insurance, 20%. After Obamacare, it dropped down to 7%. That was the biggest drop of uninsured in the entire country.
And that's even better than the national average.
Exactly. The national average, just under 10%. So in Kentucky, it was considered a big success. And what a lot of people don't understand about Obamacare, you know, you hear all this talk about the exchanges and, you know, Donald Trump's been talking about higher premiums. In places like Kentucky, the vast majority of Obama is because of Medicaid expansion. What they did was raise the eligibility from the poverty line to 133% above the poverty line. So give this in plain English. Family of four now making $33,000 a year qualifies in states like Kentucky for Medicaid. And that's been the big difference. You know, we found a couple, 60-year-old guy, who worked at a gas station. Before Obamacare, he had this insurance from the gas station, paid a maximum of $2,000 a year. He gets throat cancer, and quickly they go basically bankrupt. Under Obamacare, he's got chemo. He still has throat cancer, but he's got chemo and radiation, and they're getting the treatment for free.
And because it's Medicare, Medicaid, they have no payment.
Right.
There's no outlay for them. And it's health care they wouldn't get. The wife, who, because of the throat cancer, he can't speak, but the wife, speaking for both of them, basically saying they're still owing a lot of money from the previous insurance that only covered $2,000.
Right, and this is not a welfare case. This is a guy who worked, you know, a regular job at a gas station that just had lousy health insurance.
Right. And so now, under a Democratic governor, they accept the expansion of Medicaid as part of the program.
Right, about 30 states accepted this Medicaid expansion.
But now we move into the current situation. Kentucky, they elect a Republican governor. And
been very interesting. So the first thing that happened is the new governor of Kentucky, Matt Bevin, the first thing he did was kill the state exchange.
Connect.
Just like in Illinois, we have a state exchange, Kentucky. So that's gone. So people who did use that now have to go to the federal website, healthcare.gov. The second thing that he's trying to do, he's trying to put work requirements on those who receive Medicaid, that they would either have to work 20 hours a week, volunteer someplace, perhaps in a clinic, or go to school in order to get their health care. And for the first time, they would have to pay premiums. So that's what he's asking the Trump administration, incoming administration, for permission to do.
As a waiver from the current rules.
As a waiver. And by the way, there's no way the Obama administration was ever going to approve that waiver. But under the new regime, it's pretty clear that it will be approved.
So what this ultimately sounds like when you – and you quoted featured a Kentucky Republican legislator using the term that, well, people on this, they need to have some skin in the game. It's part of responsibility. And – you heard those arguments in the past when it came to issues of welfare. And so this brings up, is Obamacare welfare? And that's an interesting dynamic because we're talking about health care. And the idea of skin in the game when it comes to health coverage, it seems strange.
It's a phrase that you hear a lot. Actually, the governor uses it as well. And you're exactly right. It raises the basic philosophical question. Are we talking about health insurance, which is the way I think most of us look at it, or are we talking about welfare? And Democrats would point out to this idea of skin in the game that most of these folks have plenty of skin in the game. They're working 2 to 3 jobs. They're taking care of kids, maybe sick elderly relatives. They've got a lot of skin in the game. And again, we're not talking here in most cases about welfare recipients. We're talking about people maybe working 2-3 jobs to cobble together $32,000 a year in order to qualify. So these are, in many cases, the working poor, not, you know, not any kind of a welfare state.
Well, and that's why the term that was also used, too, about, you know, having to show some responsibility. Well, you know, when you're arguing about sustenance for wages and those kinds of things, that's one thing. But here again, this is health care, health coverage. Not always, you don't get sick by your own making necessarily. And, you know, responsible choices, yes, we should all make responsible choices. But that having been said, you know, health care can be a roll of the dice or when it comes to illness.
Exactly. And I think this is the question that's being framed in Washington. Is access to health care a basic right of Americans or not? And I think that question is at the heart of this proposal to repeal Obamacare.
I mean, I thought it was interesting, and the kind of payment that would be required, and it is a nominal payment. I think it was...
We're talking $180 a year, which is relatively small. And interestingly enough, some of the recipients that we talked to, including this family, Steve and Melanie Oxner, where Steve has throat cancer, they would be happy to do some extra work because having that insurance is a matter of life and death, literally, to them.
Right. It's everything for them.
Right.
And but I do think that's kind of an interesting, that aspect of it, just as, and here again, that's part of that responsibility thing because, oh, you know, we don't want to give away freebies or anything like that. But that wouldn't generate really much at all. $180 a person.
Please. Not at all. It's really not an economic thing. It's a philosophical thing. But this responsibility issue is something we're going to be hearing a lot more of because in the proposals from the Republican side in Congress, one of the big concepts is called continuous coverage, which means that you have to keep up your insurance. And if you slip, if you're late on one payment, you're going to be without insurance for a minimum of 6 months. And if you get hit by a truck or you're diagnosed with cancer, you are SOL.
Amazing. Amazing. But that's part of that responsibility.
Exactly. Exactly.
We're speaking with Chris Burry, special correspondent for PBS NewsHour, veteran newsman. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. And I'm Rick Pearson speaking with Chris Burry, special correspondent for PBS NewsHour. We're talking about his piece that aired last night, and I guess you could find it at PBS NewsHour.
It should be on the website.
On the website.
Yeah, by today or tomorrow.
And I'd encourage you to take a look at it because it kind of is a very good setup piece for what we're already seeing in this newly sworn in Congress, the efforts by the Republican-led Congress to repeal Obamacare, but no one's quite sure about the issue of replacement. And in fact, a number of Republicans even are saying maybe we shouldn't move so fast here until we figure out what we're going to replace it with. Are there parts of it to keep? Are there parts not to keep? But one of the interesting things, too, I think in the piece that aired last night was the economic issue, which I think tends to get overlooked because it's focused more on the ideological kind of issues. But the question of what it means for the economy as far as the healthcare industry.
Well, it's interesting. The former governor of Kentucky, Steve Beshear, who rolled out the program back in 2013, told us that it had created hundreds of thousands of new healthcare jobs in Kentucky. Because more people had coverage and there was greater demand for coverage. Here in the Chicago area, I talked in a separate interview for a different story covering this topic with Dr. Jay Shannon, who is the CEO of the Cook County Hospital System. And really an amazing story over there at Strozier. Before the Affordable Care Act, the great majority of patients had no health insurance, and Strozier was losing millions of dollars every year. Now, fast forward 3 years later, 2 out of 3 patients who show up at the ER at Strozier now have insurance. 2 out of 3. And for 3 years in a row now, the hospital system has broken even. This is a hospital system that...
Say that again.
In the last three fiscal years, the Cook County hospital system has broken even. And as anybody who's lived in Chicago knows, I mean, this is where... You know, the poor went for emergency care because they didn't have health insurance for years, and now two out of three have insurance, and they're at least breaking even. They're not making money. Of course, it's a nonprofit, but this is one of the largest publicly run health care systems in the United States.
Yes, and certainly through its history was always the issue of the increased funding that was needed to keep the health care system in Cook County afloat because of uninsured, because of the fact that the emergency room was the point of arrival for anybody because they didn't have insurance.
And we asked Dr. Shannon, what happens if they repeal Obamacare without a replacement? And the two words that he used were, one, nightmarish, and two, immoral. I mean, he is deeply concerned that this will be repealed and there won't be some kind of a coherent replacement. And that's the debate in Congress that you alluded to. Some in the Senate are saying, wait a minute, maybe we shouldn't repeal Obamacare until we know what the replacement is going to look like. But I think in the House, it's just the opposite sentiment. We're going to repeal this in the first week of the new Trump administration, and we'll worry about a replacement, you know, in the next year or two, whatever.
Now, one thing, when we were talking about the Medicaid expansion, and under the rules, for the most part, the early part of this Medicaid expansion is almost all federally funded.
Exactly.
But there is a kind of a phasing in to where it gets to be that states will have to pick up 10%.
Yeah, beginning this year, the states have to pick up 5%, and by 2020, it goes up to 20%. But still, you know, 90 cents out of every dollar are being picked up by the federal government.
But you've had people, and in fact, I remember even a couple of years ago, Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House now, but as a powerful Wisconsin congressman, then coming to the Tribune editorial board and basically saying states shouldn't be counting on getting that kind of reimbursement back.
But so far they have, right?
Right, but certainly an indication of what Republicans are looking at, as now they have one-party control of Washington.
I think the congressman that we kind of want to look at if we want to figure out where this is going is Tom Price, who's a Republican from Georgia. He's been nominated to be the new head of Health and Human Services. He's a vociferous opponent of Obamacare. And his proposal is interesting because it would replace health care insurance with tax credits based on age. So if you have a child, you'd get about $900 under this plan. If you're 50 years old or more, you'd get about $2,000 max. But this is not health insurance, right? This is a credit for you to go out into the market and buy health insurance if you're lucky enough to get it. And what we don't know is whether insurance companies are going to cover people with pre-existing conditions. I mean, the two really popular parts that everybody knows about, one, you know, no longer can insurance companies discriminate on the basis of pre-existing condition. And number two, you can keep your adult kids on your policy till you're 26. Both of those are immensely popular, and Donald Trump has said he wants to keep those. The problem is, if you kill the individual mandate, which is the way that you require people to pay for it, it's not clear how insurance companies could possibly afford to keep those two popular provisions.
But we do have the fact that in a number of places, Illinois too, questions about kind of this shifting landscape from insurers over, you know, what they offered, and frankly, it's a learning game for them too on the issue of who's actually going to take advantage of insurance that's offered, some getting out of various markets, those kinds of things. And I mean, it is there's an evolution going on.
Yeah, clearly parts of it were not working very well. I mean, the some of the state exchanges, as we saw in Illinois, some insurers pulled out and some raised their rates dramatically. When we were in Kentucky for a week, we saw this in the rural parts of the state. For example, Clay County in the east, all but one insurer pulled out. So if you're in the exchange there, you're not going to have the choice. Now, some people suggested there was a pretty easy fix for that, which is, well, you should raise the penalty for people not having insurance. There'll be more money for the insurance companies. But that's kind of the key of the problem here. You've got to have something like the individual mandate to force younger, healthier people to buy insurance. Otherwise, you can't pay for everybody else. But the question is the government going to be the referee here, or is it going to be private insurance companies? And that's the crux of what's going to happen here over the next 4 years.
Well, I think, true, that was part of one of the initial problems was the younger, healthier part of that equation. They were willing to take the penalty.
Exactly.
And frankly, there wasn't much of a penalty, you know, that existed initially.
And in many cases, that penalty was actually less than they would have to pay in premium. So financially, it made more sense to pay the penalty.
Given the fact that we've seen some reluctance in among Republicans there, I mean, and you actually, you know, you came to this point of the millions of Americans now who are covered and have health insurance for the very first time, that you just, it would be politically untenable, I think, among many politicians to just pull the rug right out.
I think is some concern among Republicans that they don't have a plan. They've had 6 years, right, to come up with an alternative to.
So far, though, that was always just voting repeal.
Right, exactly. And now comes the governing part. So I think you're exactly right. You know, one of the political calculations for them is going to be, whoa, wait a minute. You know, if we dismantle a system that worked for most people, not all, as we said, there were definitely problems. If we dismantle this and throw people off health insurance or make it more expensive or more difficult to get, what will the blowback be when Congress is up for reelection in 2 years? And that's why I think you're seeing some Senate Republicans stand up, especially the moderate ones. Murkowski, for example, of Alaska, Republican senator, she's saying, whoa. You know, let's hold on here. You know,
I'm curious one last thing about, and this is something that people have asked me about, that you have, in some cases, voters that we saw in this election voting against, frankly, in many cases, their own self-interest.
That's the great political irony here, Rick. I mean, you got places in Kentucky overwhelmingly went for Trump. And I think they have no idea that health insurance is about to be upended. So, you know, did they vote against their economic and health interests? Possibly. You know, I put that question, actually the first couple in the piece, Steve and Melanie, were very clear that they supported Trump. And I said, well, wait a minute. You know, do you see what's going to happen here to your health care? And Melanie said to me, I'm confident Mr. Trump, who's a good businessman, is going to figure out a way to fix it. He's not going to leave us in the lurch. We'll have to see.
And there will be much more to this story.
Exactly.
Chris Berry, thank you. Special correspondent for PBS NewsHour, co-host of In the Loop on WYCC Television, and senior journalist in residence at Chicago's DePaul University. An honor to have you here. Enjoyed your work for many years.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with 47th Ward Alderman Amaya Pawar, who is officially a candidate now for the Democratic nomination for governor.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning and welcome back to the Sunday Spin. 312-981-7200 is our phone number on this chilly Sunday morning in downtown Chicago. I'm here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue after another step out onto the WGN Storm Center patio. And while the sun is out and the skies are clear, those temperatures still very cold out there with that wind chill. That wind blowing looks like it's from the northeast, but when you're downtown, it just blows from everywhere. And yeah, it's a good brisk way to wake up this morning by going outside and getting your chill of the November air in Chicago. Well, Chris Berry and I, we were talking that last half hour about the issue of Republicans and moving forward with their efforts to repeal Obamacare, and questions about from some Republicans on how whether you just repeal it you gotta find something to help replace it as well. But with the beginning of the full Republican takeover of Washington with the swearing-in of the new Congress, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky called it the beginning of a new day.
We now stand on the horizon of a new era. We seated a new Congress yesterday. We'll inaugurate a new president later this month. The challenges ahead are great, and the work to come will be hard. But just as we heard the voices of the American people in 2014, we heard their message this last election as well. Americans call for change from the last 8 years and for hope at long last. And each of us, regardless of party, has a mandate to help and to play a role. The first way to begin realizing that hope, in my view, is to remove the things that are hurting families right now. The president-elect will have an important role to play there, especially in addressing overbearing, ideologically driven regulations. Congress will have its role, too. And in terms of what we can do here most immediately, Obamacare is at the top of the list.
That's Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell. Well, we're going to shift from Washington now to politics of the more parochial local kind. And joining me now on the phone is Alderman Amayo Pawar, 47th Ward Alderman from the Northwest Side. And Alderman Pawar is a candidate now for the Democratic nomination for Illinois governor. Alderman, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having me.
So let's just start at the top. Why would you want to be governor of this state?
So I've been watching what's been happening nationally with the campaign, and it's a reflection of what's been happening in Illinois for the last couple of years, which is, you know, you pit rural areas against cities and one community against the next, and the social safety net in this state has been collapsing. Universities are on the verge of closure, and, you know, the divisiveness, the rhetoric has a corrosive impact on our politics, our public discourse, and most importantly, working people across Illinois. So I felt like I had a voice to lend to the conversation, and that we need to have a progressive counterbalance to Governor Rauner's vision for Illinois.
One question I have, and frankly, you touched on it, the idea of, you know, pitting various elements of rural versus city, those kinds of things. And we've seen that in the rhetoric of the various campaigns. But yet, as an alderman from Chicago, mm-hmm. how does that play in other parts of the state where Chicago is not viewed as, you know, with a very loving eye?
Look, I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, I have to go around the state and talk about bringing people together and selling a progressive vision to people. But I think I don't think being a Chicago alderman should be viewed as negative in many ways. I think I'm responsible for constituents. I'm the front line in providing services to my constituents. I help connect my constituents to the state, to federal officers. So my point is, it's about going out and talking to people, talking less about pitting one group against one another, but more importantly, building community and looking at the problems facing Illinois, issues facing Illinois together, rather than saying, you know what, this school district shouldn't get a bailout. We shouldn't be providing benefits to these groups of people because, again, we're one state, and while some of us have a D or an R in front of our names when we pull the ballot, or we're independent or somewhere in between, people don't wake up every day and think and look in the mirror and say, you know what, I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican. They're people who are trying to make things work for their families, and I think that's what we should go out there and talk about.
I mean, in some of the, and we saw this in some of the legislative campaigns, particularly Republican campaigns against Democrats, where the kind of the rhetoric always included an issue like, well, this Democrat voted, downstate Democrat voted for a Chicago school bailout. Mm-hmm. And here again, that's part of playing to the regionalism that exists in the state, which is not something that's easily overcome.
So, I mean, again, I think using terms from private enterprise like bailout or strategic bankruptcy is no way to run government. Government reports to everybody, all taxpayers, Democrats, Republicans, and everyone in between. They don't report to a small group of shareholders. The second piece that I think that's important is I was in the inaugural class of the Edgar Fellowships that Governor Jim Edgar put that program together. He brought together 40 people from around the state on a bipartisan basis. And I remember one of the key things that stick out to me is he took us to a working farm outside of Champaign, and he told all of the Chicago fellows, and he said, your financial markets don't exist without the commodities, the products that are produced on this farm. That's how you are able to trade and make sure you have a financial center. And then he'd turn to the folks from around the state and say, when we're in Chicago, I want us to go on the CTA and see that this critical piece of infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, is what makes Chicago's economic engine work, is one of the components, and that we're all intertwined, we're all interconnected, and that we should see ourselves in that way. And I think that is the message, combined with helping working families, that I think people can hear.
Now, over the tenure of Governor Rauner, we've been in this budget stalemate. The governor now has pared back what he calls his turnaround agenda to certain items like a property tax freeze, term limits, some changes in workers' compensation, some pension reform. Democrats, for the most part, have resisted on this issue, largely contending that what the governor's various items in his agenda include union weakening positions, positions that would affect traditional Democratic allies. There is some talk about some movement as lawmakers come back to Springfield, but do you think there's any place to move on some of those items for as far as Democrats?
I think term limits on the executive office, I think, is great. You know, I'm hearing that there might be some compromise on term limits on legislative leaders. You know, I think Governor Rauner's ideas on consolidating various units of government, local government, is also not a bad idea. I think there are things you can compromise on. But I think there are some deal breakers. Like, for example, Governor Rauner talks about controlling costs at the local level. What he's really talking about is making it easier to privatize services, sell them off, or break them apart. I'll give you an example of why this stuff doesn't work. Chicago Public Schools recently privatized its janitorial contract and gave it to Aramark because some consultant somewhere decided that, you know, it's unbelievable that we would pay a janitor $60,000 or $70,000 a year. And so they privatized that service. And now those $70,000 a year jobs are replaced by $10 or $11 or $12 an hour contractors. So you replace the middle-class job, someone who supported a middle-class family in the city, someone who cared about the building, the students, and what was going on in the school, with a few contractors to drive down the bottom line. And the schools are filthy. It's been well reported. Teacher morale has gone down as a result. And these are the kinds of things that private sector philosophies bring to government. And it doesn't actually do anything other than drive the cost down on paper, but it has a negative impact on schools and, by the way, on accountability. And these are the kinds of things that I think we just cannot compromise on.
We're speaking with 47th Ward Alderman Amaya Pawar. He's Northwest Side Alderman and also a Democratic candidate for the nomination for governor in 2018. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue in downtown Chicago. And joining me on the phone is 47th Ward Alderman Amaya Pawar, a Democratic candidate for the nomination for governor in 2018. Alderman, we've got a call from Ron, our good friend of the show. Ron,
okay.
Happy New Year, and go ahead.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you, Rick. Alderman, question, because you do not have, you know, a lot of money, what happens is you have to have strong organizations to run. And in Illinois, that means Mike Madigan. But Mike Madigan really also makes the same argument why I would support term limits for legislative leaders. But I want you to deal with the whole thing. That's the biggest question. How do you deal with Mike Madigan? So that's it. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Ron. Alderman?
So, you know, I think it's interesting that we have a governor who ran to be the chief executive, and then after he won said, you know what, I have no power. I'm going to turn over the keys to my office and to all the power that I have, the pulpit that I have, to Speaker Madigan, and blame him for everything. Now, that's good politics to run as an outsider and say it's this person's fault why nothing is getting done. But you got the job. You asked for it. And so to constantly be the outsider when you have the job and then put $50 million of your own money and basically buy loyalty, to me, is just absurd. I think, look, the thing about politics is, and government at every level, it's relational. It requires statesmanship. It requires compromise. It requires dialogue. And sometimes you draw lines in the sand, and sometimes you compromise. But the dialogue never stops. You don't demonize other people, because just like everyone else who has to go to work every day, right? You go to work with people you like. You go to work with people you don't like. You have bosses who steal your ideas. But you still have to go home and get up and go back to work the next morning. You can't draw lines in the sand and be petulant. And my point is, if I was elected governor, I'm going to work with everybody and not draw hard lines in the sand and be a statesman. I mean, that's one of the things that Governor Edgar talks about in his Edgar Fellowship, which is partisanship is okay. But partisanship shouldn't trump public policy in every instance and shouldn't divide the state simply because we're partisans.
But, you know, that was a way that Springfield used to be. I'm not sure that that's something that Springfield could get back to. Springfield used to be different than Washington and the national polarization of politics. And now Springfield is every bit as much as polarized as mm-hmm. what we see in Washington.
So if I may, I mean, I think this is what's most frustrating to me. It's like, look, I want to present a progressive vision. And address income inequality. But I think one of the things that we need to start talking about is government is a force for good. I truly believe that. But it's only a force for good if we elect people who believe in government, people who understand government, people who understand that government exists because people want there to be a balance between working people and big corporations, working people and the very wealthy. Because when there is a balance, we can lift all boats. But when you have a narrative that everything that government does, and this is something that's happened over the last 40 years after LBJ and the Great Society, which is government is evil. Don't feed the beast. Government is corrupt. Everything is bloated. Privatized services. You get to a point where we constantly have to do more with less. Raising revenue becomes a third rail. And then everyone looks at government as if every proposal is coming from a bad place. And I think it's time to hit the reset button, have an honest dialogue about government, the role it plays, how it can shape our future. But more importantly, remember that after the Great Depression, it wasn't big business's excesses that helped us climb out. It was a federal government role, a government's role, and people coming together that created the greatest middle class we've ever seen. So I still believe government is a force for good, and that narrative needs to change, and that starts with dialogue.
It seems to me part of how you see your path is largely almost kind of in a retail sense of politics. And that's something very difficult to do on a state level. You touched on the fact that, you know, shortly before the new year, Governor Rauner put $50 million of his own money into his campaign account. You don't have those kinds of resources. So what is the path here for you?
I mean, I think the path is, look, like most people in the state, I can't write a $50 million check, $1 million check. I can't even write a seven-figure check, right? That shouldn't mean I shouldn't run. I think my goal is I'm going to go out and raise money. I'm just getting started. I think I have good name recognition here in the city of Chicago and in the Collier counties and Cook County. And I'm going to go out and around the state and go talk to people, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. I think it's important that if we're presenting a progressive vision to voters, that you go talk to everybody and as many people as possible. So, you know, we have people reaching out who want to host coffees around the state, and we'll go and do that. So maybe, you know, I won't have party leaders meeting with me, or maybe, you know, other officials may see my candidacy as a too big of a long shot in the near term. But I'm going to go out and talk to people about a progressive vision and strip away those partisanship lines, instead try to just focus on issues facing all Illinoisans, like how we fund public education. It's very regressive. We're the fourth largest economy in the country, dead last in public education settings. Talk about universal daycare, criminal justice reform, and talk about a jobs and capital bill.
Now, I know you have also talked about in the progressive way about the issue of how income inequality, the major issue, but also you've talked about changing the income tax structure to basically we change our current flat tax to have a multi-tiered rate. That's been talked about in Springfield before, and it hasn't gone anywhere. And part of it is, you know, here again, I think a public fear about that third rail of taxes, because you'd have to change the Constitution to do it.
Well, I think there's other ways to get at a more progressive system. You know, Senator Don Harmon had a great bill that, you know, deserves greater debate. I think there, obviously, the constitutional change is another route. I think that there is a millionaire's tax that has done well on the ballot across the state. I think it's important to recognize that whether you're in the upper middle class, or in the working poor, if you're that we're all in the same boat. We all pay more than our fair share in taxes. It's the folks at the very, very top that benefit the most from a regressive tax system. That is, they pay the same rate that we do. And that doesn't mean they're bad people. It just means that the system has to be rethought so that it's actually fair, so we can pay for the services to lift all boats. There is no reason why only a handful of suburbs and communities around the state should be able to pay what every student deserves per pupil in education spending, just because they have a higher tax base and they can generate higher property taxes. So these are issues that I think are common to all Illinoisans. I just think it's a matter of how we start the conversation. It's not about saying wealth is evil. Wealth is great. It should be celebrated. It just shouldn't be worshipped. Wealth shouldn't be the only pre-qualifier for public office. And more importantly, paying your fair share, if you are one of these wealthy individuals, is a good thing, because that is how we keep things in balance. And if we realize anything from our history, whether it was the stock market crash in the 20s, the Great Depression, or 08, is that when you restore balance between business and government and business and working people, good things happen. You can create middle-class jobs. But once it gets out of whack, like it has today, there's a lot of hard work that needs to be done. But more importantly, that balance needs to be restored.
That's Alderman Amaya Pawar, 47th Ward Alderman from the Northwest Side, and a candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor. Alderman, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to Raja Krishnamoorthy. He's the Schaumburg Democrat who's the newly minted congressman from the 8th Congressional District.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue in Tribune Tower. We talked about the issues of Obamacare, but Trump's cabinet nominees have begun making the rounds of senators. Illinois senior Democratic Senator Dick Durbin met recently with Trump's nominee for attorney general. That's Alabama Republican Senator Jeff Sessions. And yes, while they're Senate colleagues, Durbin, who's a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, says he has some concerns about Sessions.
My first priority was to discuss what I consider to be a heartbreaking and terrible situation in the city of Chicago when it comes to the number of homicides. We've had over 760 homicides in Chicago this year, I should say last year, and that was more than Los Angeles and New York combined. It is a record-breaking number for the city, at least going back to the 1990s. And there are two things that the mayor of Chicago is looking for, that we're all looking for. One, resources to hire more police provide more training and more equipment. And secondly, an effort by the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice to take a look at the management of the police department, find a way to make it better, more effective, and to restore confidence in the community with our local police department. I asked Senator Sessions point blank, will you support maintaining and increasing the funds for COP grants, for burn grants, for federal resources that could come back to cities like Chicago and Baltimore and St. Louis and help them through these crises. He was not prepared to make that commitment.
That's U.S. Senator Dick Durbin after meeting with the Republican nominee for Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Joining me now on the phone is Rajna Krishnamurthy. He's a Schaumburg Democrat, and he's the newly minted congressman from the 8th Congressional District. Congressman Krishnamurthy, thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, good morning, Rick. How are you?
Good morning. So I guess you're doing the learning training sessions out there in D.C. right now?
That's right. How to be a congressman. it's been...
There's so many ways you could go with that, you know.
there are. Hopefully we follow best practices. But basically this has been quite a week, Rick. On Tuesday, I was sworn in, and I had all my family with me, or a lot of my family. We had almost a busload of family in attendance, and I had my two little boys sitting with me and on my lap for the swearing in, and it was a really thrilling moment for our family.
And I know it's been a long time coming for you.
Yeah, I ran once before for Congress, and I took the silver medal in 2012. But after that race, where we ran a very dignified campaign, we didn't attack our opponent at that time, Tammy Duckworth. And the interesting thing is that Tammy and I became very good friends after that race, and she actually appointed me as an advisor to her office and so forth. But the upshot is 4 years later, she runs for Senate, and that opened up the spot, and I ran for her seat. And, we prevailed in a multiple candidate primary with almost 60% of the vote. And then we won the general election again with almost 60% of the vote and won a lot of Republican and Democratic votes. So I feel very good about the outcome.
I want to ask you, going in now with kind of the very massive changes that are going on in Washington, starting at the top with a Republican president to the fact of total Republican control of Congress, you're coming in as a Democrat. How much can you reasonably expect to achieve anything?
Well, it depends on what the incoming president's priorities are and how they align or don't align with the House Republican caucus. Right now, the House Republican caucus is pursuing one set of policies I don't necessarily agree with. Rick, I campaign on a platform of, how do we grow and strengthen the middle class and working families? That's kind of the only thing that I've been talking about for about 2 years now.
Plus, that was initial floor speech, too.
That was my initial floor speech. Yes, it was that was what I focused on. And, I think that if the incoming president makes that a priority, I hope to be a constructive partner. And, he may we don't know if, for instance, he's going to pursue that transportation and infrastructure package that he's been talking about. That would be terrific for my district because that is perhaps near the top of the agenda for constituents there, because I would represent the O'Hare Industrial Region, which is, as you know, a confluence of the country's busiest airport, along with numerous highways and railroads. And the Elgin O'Hare Expressway, which cuts right through, doesn't reach Elgin and doesn't reach O'Hare at this point. And we'd like to see that change. I'd like to see that be a part of the package if he ends up unveiling that in the coming months.
There is so much that's kind of an unknown, and the question of and as you point out, what there may be the House Republican agenda versus a Donald Trump agenda, and I mean we kind of even saw a little bit of that even before things started rolling when the issue of the House Republicans wanting to get rid of the ethics office, and then were forced to do a very quick about face, which did not.
Oh my goodness, that was quite a about face on earlier this week. You know, we were all shocked. You know, basically, you know, for your listeners, and this is kind of new to me, but basically, on the day of your swearing in, you as a new member of the Congress have to vote on certain rules, but they're rather perfunctory in the sense of, you know, when is the cafeteria going to be open and, you know, that stuff like that, which is, you know, not very controversial. But the night before, we get word that the House Republicans, you know, want to gut the ethics office. And, you know, instead of focusing on the agenda that I talked about, you know, how do we help middle class families and working families? This is their first move out of the box. And as you know, President-elect Trump tweeted that he was very concerned about this move. And I think that tweet, along with other criticism, caused them to do quite an about face within 24 hours. So fortunately, that didn't make it into the rules package. But there were other rules that were concerning. And I've learned in 1 week that, you know, one of the reasons people don't necessarily trust Congress is they're not focused on the things that really matter to working families and the middle class. They're kind of distracted by a lot of other issues.
You're, as a new congressman, you're obviously going to be dealing a lot with constituent services. And in the myriad of the bureaucracy of Washington, that would seem to be almost a preeminent job for you.
It is. You know, I'm really glad you brought that up, Rick. We are putting a premium on this particular issue. How do we help people with their everyday issues? You know, everything from making sure that they're getting their Social Security checks or disability payments to, you know, making sure that families get tours of the Capitol and flags for various occasions, and then also serious issues related to immigration. And so we want to make sure that we're there for our constituents. And also we want to promote their economic interests, which is paramount to me. As I said before, you know, my agenda is basically how do we grow and strengthen the middle class and working families. So I would like to bring folks together in my district, Republicans and Democrats, and figure out what do they want and what do their constituents want, and make sure to give voice to that on Capitol Hill and do whatever we can to stitch coalitions to make moves, however incremental they might be, to build up to something significant.
Well, and as a businessman too, I mean, that's a thriving business district that you represent in the Northwest and West suburbs. I mean, which kind of is in a unique posture for a Democrat, yet you've been a successful businessman.
Yes, sir. I think that's one reason why I believe that I have some, you know, added credibility with my Republican colleagues, a lot of whom are entrepreneurs or small business people. And I've noticed even now talking to my freshman colleagues, Republican freshman colleagues and others, that, you know, we connect rather quickly because I can say that I've had to meet the payroll and keep my customers happy and win new business for my company. And how do we make sure government, nurtures the growth of small businesses, which are the engine of our economy, at the same time, you know, standing up for working families and middle-class families who are struggling, Rick. You know, it used to be that blue-collar families and workers were the ones that were concerned about the next layoffs, and now white-collar families are in the same boat. You know, we have Sears in my district, which is kind of been struggling lately. Motorola has been undergoing changes, which is headquartered in my district. McDonald's is in the southern part. A lot of their employees and owner-operators are in my district, and they've undergone some changes over the last few years. So the sum total is that I'm a big proponent of nurturing small and medium-sized businesses, and at the same time, you know, living up to my kind of progressive credo, which is how do we help people climb the economic ladder.
We're speaking with Raja Krishnamoorthy. He's the newly minted congressman from the 8th Congressional District. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio, and joining me on the phone is Raja Krishnamoorthy. He is the Schaumburg Democrat who is the new 8th Congressional District Representative. Representative Krishnamoorthy, we started the program this morning talking about the fate of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and I know that Democrats will acknowledge that the program isn't perfect, and in many respects, you know, concerns about the impact on small businesses. But yet, here among many Republicans, the move to want to move quickly to repeal it without necessarily looking for a replacement. What do you see going on over there as you look across the aisle?
Well, first of all, I agree that there are challenges with the ACA, and I said don't end it, let's mend it. Unfortunately, on the other side of the aisle, I do see it feels very political to me, Rick, because basically what they're saying is we're going to repeal it, but we don't have a replacement for it. And here's the problem. First of all, you know, the Congressional Budget Office has already said that that move alone would increase the debt or the compound deficits by hundreds of billions of dollars over the next 10 years. Secondly, it would basically cause Illinois to lose almost 100,000 jobs and maybe $13 billion, upwards of $13 billion with a B, in lost economic output. And then most importantly, it would potentially rob 20 to 30 million people of their health care. And that's pretty serious if you think about it, given how many people are relying on it, in some cases for life-saving treatments. And this is not stuff that you want to tinker with lightly. So if they have a replacement plan that is going to improve things, then they should put it out there right away and adopt it, vote on it at the same time that they move to repeal. But at this point, they're just talking about repealing and there's no replacement. So that's very, very, very dangerous.
No, and indeed, you're seeing some Senate Republicans saying we ought to slow down on this and until there is some kind of a replacement that exists.
Right. I think that until they do so, come up with a replacement plan, this talk of a repeal sounds very political to me. And I'm just looking at it from a common sense perspective, which is that, you know, there are a lot of businesses, a lot of industries, a lot of people who have basically structured their lives now to rely on the ACA and Obamacare as it is right now. Are there problems? Absolutely. And we've talked about these before. But let's work on trying to solve those problems. I don't believe that we should repeal it, and I certainly don't believe we should repeal it without a replacement.
You touched also on the issue of the president-elect wanting a huge, in his words, infrastructure program. And I guess, you know, is that realistic to expect a huge infrastructure program when you've basically had Republicans in control of the House have been preaching austerity?
Let's see. I think that the president-elect is correct about the need for something significant on the infrastructure side because, you know, our infrastructure is dilapidated, Rick. You know this. Our roads, highways, bridges are in disrepair. There are lots of incomplete infrastructure projects which are causing bottlenecks all over the Chicago area. And then there's also other types of infrastructure that has to be modernized, everything from our grid, electrical grid, to bandwidth for internet. Other countries are really eating our lunch in this department. And so, Illinois is no longer competing with just, Indiana or Iowa. It's competing with China and other countries. So I hope that the president does do something significant and there's a funding source for it. But that is obviously something he has to work out with his House Republicans.
So we'll stay tuned.
Exactly. With this president-elect, we know some things about him, but there's a lot of question marks. And I think that in the coming months, he's really going to be fleshing out his agenda. I really, really hope that he focuses on those working families and middle-class families who are getting pinched and squeezed left and right. They're not seeing a great increase in their salaries over the years. And at the same time, expenses like higher education, child care, health care, and other staple expenses for their everyday lives are skyrocketing. And so I really hope that he focuses some effort on that particular issue. If he does, then I will try to be a constructive partner. On the other hand, if he persists with rhetoric from the campaign that isolates people or divides people or tries to somehow persecute certain people based on their race or where they came from or religion or gender or so forth, then I will take a stand against them. But let's hope that he takes a better course.
That's Raja Krishnamoorthy. He is the Schaumburg Democrat who is the newly minted congressman from the 8th Congressional District. Congressman, thank you for joining me and congratulations.
Hey, thank you so much, Rick. I really appreciate the opportunity.
We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Chris Burry, Ameya Pawar, and Raja Krishnamoorthy. And I want to thank all of you for listening as we move forward to a very politically interesting 2017. But now, for the lighter side of things, it's the great Dean Richards.
Hey, we've got our share of controversy also. The Golden Globes are tonight.
That's right.
My second most exhausting night of the year. This would be my equivalent of your election night,
yes.
Sort of, because the Academy Awards are the mother of them all.
So how late are you up dealing with
this? I'm probably going to stay up all
night. The all-nighter?
Yeah. Normally for these big award shows, especially this Golden Globes, because there may be some alcohol imbibed during the show, which makes it one of the more entertaining shows of the year. It tends to run a little long. So, we have to kind of prepare everything for tomorrow morning for TV.
Right.
So, at some point, it's like, do I go to bed for an hour or do I just stay awake? I'll probably feel better if I just stay awake.
I understand.
Which I sometimes do. But La La Land is up today in Moonlight and Manchester by the Sea. And Jimmy Fallon's going to be hosting. So there's plenty to talk about in that regard. I don't know if any of it's as interesting as a single Donald Trump tweet, but nonetheless.
I just saw that there's an app, so like if you have stock in a company and Donald Trump tweets something about that company,
It
will give you a notification.
Right. Yeah, that's a big deal.
I mean,
if you get either a blessing or a curse from him, it
does change the market a little bit.
It's interesting.
Yes.
It's going to be an interesting 4 years.
But are the Golden Globes actually any kind of precursor?
I don't think so. They certainly haven't been the past several years, that's for sure. If it has been, it's been strictly by coincidence. The voting for the nominations for the Oscars ended this past Friday. So whatever happens tonight is not going to influence any voting except right. that if anything was already nominated, purely coincidental. The Golden Globes are given out by a very small group called the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. It's 90 dopey entertainment reporters like me who comprise this group, as opposed to the Motion Picture Academy, which is thousands and thousands of people who are voting. So it's a much smaller body. People watch the show because they drink at the show and you can see your favorite stars drunk on stage. That's the main attraction for the Golden Globes tonight.
Okay, I guess I'll be watching.
Well, you'll have a preview of it all. I've got my predictions all coming up.